Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner at Heritage Resources versus Nations Bank.
The Supreme Court has denied the argument
from petitioner. Petitioner has been May it please the Court. We're here today to attempt to correct two egregious errors made by the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals in El Paso. One of these errors concerns general contract construction principles and applying those principles to the facts at hand. This definitely has a detrimental effect on my client and indirectly on all litigants, all practitioners in the state of Texas. The second egregious error concerns the effect of construction of division orders in the oil and gas context, specifically in the gas context, and not only has a detrimental effect on my client, but if this case is upheld and the language contained in this case is allowed to stand, it will have a very detrimental effect on the oil and gas industry as a whole. My client, the petitioner, is Heritage Resources. We were the operator of various wells in Winkler County, Texas. The respondents were the lessors and the owners of undivided interest in minerals in Winkler County, Texas, who executed six different oil and gas leases, either the respondents or their predecessors. Heritage owns undivided interest in four of these leases and owns no interest in two of the leases. But it is the operator of the wells on all the leases. Each of the leases, the facts in this case are pretty much agreed upon. It's just a question of the law and what the law does to those facts. The six different oil and gas leases are virtually identical, and they the royalty clause, the clause at issue, is virtually identical. It provides initially for a royalty of either one-fourth or one-fifth of the market value at the well of any gas sold. They go on to say, after that, provided, however, there shall be no deduction from the value of lessor's royalty by reason of any required processing cost of dehydration, compression, and, as important here, transportation to market such gas. Heritage's operator sold the gas off the lease premises and did deduct transportation costs from the gross proceeds received at that point off of the lease premises. The trial court and the court of appeals held that that breached the terms of the royalty agreement. Where the trial court and the court of appeals both erred is in determining what the deduction can come from. It's clear in the lease. The deduction can be made from the value of lessor's royalty. There shall be no deduction from the value of lessor's royalty. Now, deducting transportation costs from the gross proceeds received off the lease premises is not the same thing as deducting transportation costs from the value of lessor's royalty.
Well, the only way to deduct it from the royalty would be to deduct it twice. Surely you don't need to be told you can't deduct it twice.
You're speaking, Your Honor, of the instance where the gas would be sold at the well. And in that instance, we can't deduct it. That's correct, Your Honor.
No, I'm saying if you're going to deduct it to get down to the market value price on which the royalty is computed, sure you can't deduct it again.
No, Your Honor, we're not saying that we can deduct it again.
But you're saying that's all that means.
What we're saying is that it means that if our deduction from the gross proceeds received at a point off the well is greater than the difference between the market value at the well and the market value were sold, then we breached the contract. Your Honor, I have a hypo in my brief, and here, it's not in very good shape at this point in time, but it is nevertheless a hypo, a chart showing my hypothetical, and goes back to my law school days, I guess, but hypotheticals always help me to understand the point of what's going on. In this case, Your Honor, the market value of the gas at point A, which is at the well, measured by comparable sales, that's the preferential way of determining market value at the well, is by comparable sales in the area and the same, all the rules that this court has set down to determine market value of the well. In the hypothetical situation, gas is sold at point B for $2 per MCF.
Why is it more at B than A?
Because it takes, it's more valuable there because the lessee has to pay to get it to point B.
You've got to take out the transportation cost.
That's correct, yeah. Now, but under the appellate court's interpretation, let's go on one step further. Assume that we, instead of selling it at point B, we sold it at point C to the end user, and that would be at an even higher price. It would be $6 per MCF. What the respondents would argue is that if we sold it at point E,
point which?
I mean at point A, they would get 40 cents per MCF, because that's 1/4 of the market value of the gas at the well. We don't disagree there. That's easy. Now what they're saying is that if we sold at point B, where the price is $2 per MCF, that they would get 50 cents per MCF instead of the 40 cents per MCF, which flies in the face of the lease clause that says they're to get 1/4 of the market value of the gas at the well. The only way you can, and likewise, if they sold for $6 down here, they would get $1.50 per MCF as royalty, when the market value of the gas at the well is really $1.60. They'd be getting almost everything the market value of the gas at the well. That's clearly not what was intended. The only way you can harmonize these two clauses and not disregard the market price at the well language, which, by the way, Your Honor, there's nothing in here that defines specifically that says the value of the lessor's royalty shall be. It provides that the royalty interest will be 1/4 of the market value of the gas at the well. So in my way of looking at that, that defines what the value of lessor's royalty is.
Is there any contention in this case that the lessors are entitled to higher of proceeds or market value? Is there any argument about that?
No, I've not seen any argument about that, Your Honor. If, I'll say this, if we sold the gas out here for $2 and we deducted 30 cents to get it there, then they would be entitled to their proportionate part of $1.70. That would be higher. I mean, that would be, in effect, what you're saying, Your Honor. It would be, if the gross proceeds or the net proceeds were higher than the market value of the well, then they'd be entitled to that. We would not breach the agreement unless we paid them less than 40 cents per MCF. Actually, in that instance, as long as we paid them 40 cents per MCF, in that instance, we would not be breaching the agreement.
Woodward, your position is that in the course of this trial, your client was sued. The plaintiffs failed to prove the market value of the well.
That's
they
correct.
Simply, for their entire proof, they simply said they received X dollar at point B and deducted transportation, and so we win. And you're
right.
Saying that
I'm
the element of their proof was they have yet to prove what the fair market value at the well was.
And one step further, they have failed to prove what the value of lessor's royalty is, which is defined in the lease as either 1/4 or 1/5 of the market value of the well. So in order to get there, in order to determine what the value of the lessor's royalty is, you have to determine what the market value is as well. In a case like this, Your Honor, also I would point out that goes to the evidentiary question that was one of my points of error, which the Court of Appeals certainly misinterpreted. We've never said that we didn't deduct transportation costs. What we've said is there is no proof that we deducted transportation costs from the value of lessor's royalty, which is two different things. As long as we don't deduct transportation costs from the value of lessor's royalty, we've not breached the lease.
You
so
agree,
in other words,
you agree if the market value at the well was greater than the remaining proceeds when you sell at point B and subtract transportation, that you would have to pay them more
yes,
than
Honor.
The money you had.
That's exactly what, yes, Your Honor. I would agree with that 100%. The problem with that is And the reason why this case is, should be reversed and rendered rather than reversed and remanded to determine what that market value is, that it's their burden of proof, it's the lessor's burden of proof to show what the market value of the gas at the well is and what the value of the lessor's royalty is. The only proof in the record is the alternative way of measuring the market value of gas at the well, which Justice Peck, I think, was alluding to before, is if you have the market value at a price off the lease and you deduct the reasonable cost of getting it from there, that's how you arrive at the market value at the well. That's one way, but that's not necessarily, there could be some anomaly that would cause that to be different than if you use the comparable sales in the area. That all the cases that
because
said,
the gathering costs were excessive for some reason, right, in a particular way.
Or the price received at point B was less than it should have been or more than it should have been. So the preferable way would be to have comparable sales in the area and determine what the market value of the well was, therefore what the value of lessor's royalty was, and then determine if we had indeed deducted transportation costs to the extent that it went below the market value of gas at the well.
Your brief doesn't mention certain amendments to the division orders, not just the trial court's findings, in fact, the conclusions of law, but the response brief talks about certain amendments. Apparently,
Your Honor, that goes to the second division, the second error that the court made, and that refers to the error in the division order.
I just want to know, factually, are there, tell me what he's talking, what the brief means when they're talking about these amendments to division orders. There's
okay, what happened on each of the amendments? I mean, on each of the division orders. Not only the ones that had this language struck through, but the ones that allowed this language to stay in there about the deduction of transportation costs had it stamped, that the bank, as trustee, had stamped on the division orders, and in the appellate court's opinion, it says exactly what those say. But basically, they say that the execution of the division order will not amend, despite anything stated herein to the contrary, the execution of this instrument is not intended to alter or amend the lease or any amendment thereto pertaining, covering our interest or interest shown in this instrument. My position, Your Honor, that this court in the past has, to be quite honest, it seems to me, struggled with what to do with division orders. They haven't struggled with what to do with the end result. The end result is that they're effective if they lower the cost of the gas or the amount to be paid, they're effective until such time as they're revoked. The court has also stated that a division order does not amend or supplant the lease.
I'm just saying, I want specifically, is there any dispute about whether that stamp is part of the division order or not? Did you all concede that? Or did you contest
it? I concede that it's part of the division order, yes, Your Honor, it's part of the division order. My argument on that is it has no effect because it's not. Division orders are not intended to be an amendment of the lease. If it were an amendment of the lease, then the term, it couldn't be revoked. The terms of the lease would no longer be effective and the division order would be effective. As I started to say, that the court has, in the past, early on, called a division order a contract. The problem with that is there was a little problem of consideration in some instances. And the court has said that it's a revocable contract. But, of course, if it's a contract, then you can't revoke it without having some kind of consequences. Then, the later cases relied on detrimental reliance. They said the purchaser or the operator had relied on the execution of that division order, and therefore was allowed to rely on it until such time as it was revoked. But then we had a problem somewhat, and maybe there wasn't any detrimental reliance. So I think the latest statement was that the division orders were for stability in the oil and gas industry to provide the purchaser with knowledge that if there was a division order executed, that he could rely on that until such time as it was revoked. There's an excellent article by Richard Brown delivered at the 18th Annual University of Texas School of Law, Oil, Gas, Mineral Law Institute, March 27, 1992. He'd argued that really what a division order is, it should be analyzed as an executory accord as to marketing or accounting. There is, in a gas situation, there is a, all of the gas is owned by the working interest owner. There's a sale. That results in a debt. But there's a dispute as to exactly how that debt should be paid, who it should be paid to, that sort of thing. So an executory accord is entered into between the parties, and they agree to, for the future discharge of an existing debt by a substituted performance. What he says is the accord itself does not satisfy, but when you perform under that executory accord, if you perform under the division order, then that satisfies the payment of the debt until such time as it's revoked. Once it's been revoked, then you go back to the lease and you're stuck with those terms.
Any questions? Mr. Woodward, I have a couple of questions. You state that the Court of Appeals decision is clearly wrong and it's going to impact the oil and gas industry.
That
was your statement, correct?
Yes.
All right. Is there any explanation as to why the oil and gas market has not found any amicus briefs here to support your position?
Your Honor, I don't know. I've gotten calls from three or four different people.
The fact is, no one has filed amicus briefs.
No one has filed one.
We have
number two, second question. What do you make of this language that the Court of Appeals construed? And the Court of Appeals took the position parties have a right to contract. And language means something, and this language clearly, according to the Court of Appeals, shows, if you look at the four corners of the lease, the intent of the parties was that they were going to specifically exempt the royalties from post-production costs. Now, that was their reading of it by the trial court and the Court of Appeals. Now, what is your reading of this language? What does that language mean?
Your Honor, that language simply means what the trial court and the Court of Appeals are failing to look at. They say that they agree that there won't be any post-production costs, but that's not what it says. It says there will be no post-production costs deducted from the value of lessor's royalty. It doesn't say there'll be, there are all numerous ways. The canons of construction, Your Honor, we can't look at the subjective intent of the parties. We don't know what they intended to say. All we know is what they wrote down, what they said, and what to me, their objective intent was that there would be no deduction from the value of lessor's royalty. If they wanted to say there's no deductions whatsoever, they could have put there should be no deduction from the gross proceeds received.
How can it be more clear? No deduction from the value of lessor's royalty by reason of any required processing costs, cost of dehydration, compression, transportation costs, or other matter to market such gas. How can that be more clear?
Your Honor, it is clear. The question is, what are those deductions from? What are you not allowed to deduct those costs from? We're not saying that we can deduct as much as we want there. We can deduct, you know, some inordinate amount. What we're saying is as long as we don't get below the value of lessor's royalty, we have not breached the terms of that lease.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Robert Bowman will present argument for respondents.
May it please the court. The petitioner is correct in regard to the canons of construction of contracts. We have a contract here. We have six contracts, and they're similar in their language as the royalty clauses. It is from the four corners that we must construe it. The petitioner cites in its brief, and I believe it's the case of Woods v. Sims, that the parties intended to put in each clause that's in a contract. The clause had to mean something. To go along or to be consistent with interpretation of the petitioner, you have to ignore about one-third of the words and the language in the royalty clause.
Ms. Scogin, what is your proof in the record of the fair of the market value of the gas at the well?
All right, so let me articulate something that's probably not in the brief. If you will look at the royalty clauses, it provides...
I'm just asking for the proof, not the lease. What what is...
Point A, this is the point of sale. Point B is the point of sale.
What is the market value of the gas at the well?
The market value of the gas at the well is the gas produced and sold. That's what's provided in the lease. You have to have produced and sold. Market itself kind of takes the word sold or exchange.
It's your position that at whatever point there is cash that changes hands, that's the market value of the gas.
Because the lease, and I was getting back to that, Your Honor, says it is the gas that, the market value at the well is the gas that is produced and sold. You've got to have both of them in there, produced and sold, to have a market. And the point where the gas is sold is in the record is at point B.
The gas might be more valuable at point B than point A, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am, it would be more valuable at point C because of...
What evidence is there in the record offered by anyone as to the market value of the gas at the wellhead?
There is.
The gas at the wellhead has an exit valve.
There is never a market value of the gas at the wellhead. The leases don't provide that. The leases provide that the market gas at the wellhead is defined as the gas produced and sold.
Are you saying that market value is equivalent to proceeds?
Yes, it has to be.
Always?
Oh, or an exchange of something, perhaps.
How do you deal with Mr. Woodward's statement that if you read it the way you want it read, it is possible that the royalty would take all of the proceeds? You sold it for $6 out here, and then you end up with $1.60, which would be virtually all of the market value at the wellhead.
Well, that can occur, Your Honor, particularly in this situation, because the operator, Heritage, in this field, is owned by one person, all the stock. The gathering company is Urantia, and the majority of it is owned by the same person. It's a rather cozy little arrangement.
Are you alleging or seeking to prove any type of, you said that in the brief, and you're saying it here, but are you trying to make anything of it?
No, I'm just saying that these things can happen because you have A buying from A. A is doing the transporting for itself and for the royalty.
But you're not alleging anything other than fair market value.
I'm just saying it's fair market value, and the fair market value, according to the lease, is the gas produced and sold. That's the wellhead value.
Is it your position then that nobody ever buys gas at the wellhead?
Not at the exit valve. They do not, Your Honor. It's impossible. You have to meter it. Then that would be the minimum amount you'd have to do to meter it.
Well, it's metered at the wellhead in any event, it's not. It's metered at the wellhead in any event. The person,
well,
there may not be a purchase meter, but there's a meter at the wellhead.
Okay. It's not at the wellhead, Your Honor. A meter is some distance from the wellhead. The wellhead is a device that's right here. It has an exit valve where the gas comes up from the earth and goes out. It goes into a pipeline. Then it goes some distance before it's metered. Then after it's metered, it may go be compressed, dehydrated, treated, scrubbed. It has different things that are done to it depending upon the quality of the gas that comes from the well. There's usually very, very seldom any absolute pure gas that comes from a well. Something has to be done to it.
So it's your position then that in the hypothetical shown on that diagram that you would never have a price, quote, of gas sold at the wellhead?
Not an absolute price at the wellhead.
In this example, you wouldn't ever be able to find a comparable sale of $1.60.
No, not the wellhead, not the exit valve, but not the wellhead, no, Your Honor.
So what does the price at the wellhead mean?
As it's explained, or as it's defined in the royalty clause, the gas produced and sold. It's in
somewhere off the lease, then.
It could be on the lease, it could be off the lease, wherever it's sold, Your Honor. Because that is the language of the gas division. And I apologize for that, and I've been more articulated in the brief. But you have to look at the first part of this, of each of these royalty clauses, it's produced and sold.
So you don't really look at how far it has to reach, how far it's transported. It's just wherever the sale takes place. And if one lease is $6 and the other three are $2,
Your Honor, that you're going to have to face down the road because of the federal regulations of unbundling pipelines. You're going to have to face a very complex question of where it's sold. This was easy.
Council is the...
We know where it was sold because they cut the checks there.
Putting it produced and sold, that allows there to be a loss between point A and point B that would not prejudice anybody. By saying we're going to have the sale price at point A, if there should be a rupture in the line, in the gathering line there, then that gas is lost as for record purposes, never been used.
Yes, sir, we have those blowout well cases.
So by saying sold is protection for both sides.
And in your example, yes, sir.
Well, I'm just trying to figure out why you would have a different
produce and sold. You can't have a market value without having a sale. It's just almost impossible to have a market without a sale.
How do you distinguish the cases cited in petitioner's brief? There are a number of them. Texas Oil and Gas versus Hagen, Puno, Phillips Petroleum, Sartor, that hold, I thought, that at market value at the wellhead is the, you back out the value at the market value at the point of sale and back out transportation and processing charges. How do you distinguish those cases?
I don't know the exact language of the royalty clauses in those cases, you know. So I'm not prepared to distinguish those cases, except that they are defining market value as I would define market value. You've got a sale. At a point, you've got a sale. You have got a market, whatever it is.
And the position. To focus on my inquiry about the evidence, if the court decides that produced and sold does not change the view that it's the market value at the wellhead, then you lose.
Yes, Your Honor.
So the issue really is how we say produced and sold affects the valuation in this case.
Where the market is, where the market value is, Your Honor. Where is the market value? That's the question. And if the market value is at point
C, after it's been gathered, this small gathering line, including the main pipeline, then
the lease is very clear that you do not deduct transportation costs or any other costs. And again, if you look at the division, the royalty clause, it says transportation or other matters to market such gas. The word market is used in two places in these royalty clauses. One is to define what the value of the wellhead is. It's a market value at the wellhead, then it says it's defined there as produced and sold. Then you go down to the end of the clause and it says, to our other matters to market such gas. There'll be no deduction. And this is where it's marketed.
At point B. That's where the check is done. Heritage
took on the role as paymaster. They operated, they engaged into a pipeline contract, they took the money and distributed it amongst the royalty owners and the other working interest owners, and deducted the transportation costs from the royalty owners, which the lease prohibits. If you get into the, in a little bit further as to who is responsible, petition goes into the brief about it's not responsible for the other working interest owners. I think under the Natural Resource Code it is. It was the first purchaser. It was the payor. It was the one collecting the money, distributing the money. That you need not make these other working interest owners parties.
Counsel, if you had two wells, though, at point A, that had different ownership.
Yes, sir.
But both wells flew in, go into the same gathering line, and go to point B.
Yes, sir.
How are you going to figure then? But
Each well has its own meter.
Well, it has its own meter, I think.
Yes, each well has its own meter.
Then, so you can figure how much it is really, how much is really produced at that well.
The volume, yes, sir.
Yeah.
But there's no market there. There's a meter at each well that determines the volume of gas that has been produced in that well.
But doesn't that concept sort of assume then that the producer also transports it to point B?
Yes. Or has it transported, whether it actually physically has its own pipelines and makes arrangements for a gathering company to do it, to the point of sale. There was no sale made at the meter. The sale was made at point B. Produced and sold. And from that, there was a deduction of the transportation costs, and that's what the trial court awarded to respondent, was that transportation cost that was deducted from point A to point B, where there was a sale and checks were cut and made payable to the various parties. And the evidence is undisputed as to the money, the value of it, the transportation cost. There's no dispute there. You get to the division orders. The division orders have a stamp on them. It says the division orders do not change the leases. It's articulated in the Court of Appeals opinion on page 11. If you're going to say you have to look at the division order from the four corners, then you have to take in consideration that stamp. And if they did not agree to that stamp, they should have sent the division orders back or not paid. But they paid under division orders that stamp thereon. And that stamp states that these division orders do not alter the oil and gas leases.
Is there any question by the respondent that the transportation costs that were charged were unreasonable?
No, everything. There's no dispute about damages, Your Honor. No dispute about
it. You agree with their position that the material facts are without dispute.
Correct.
How you interpret the lease and apply the interpretation.
Yes, sir. That's correct. There's no dispute of facts here. This went on summary judgment. We later tried it to the bench just to clean it up. And, partial summary judgment, because we had attorney fees and anything. When we had to prove attorney fees, we just tried it again before the bench. And the court filed its findings of fact and conclusions of law. Now, if petitioner wants other working interest owners, which was a non-operator, to share in the burden of these transportation costs as to their interest, there's always a third-party practice in Texas that you can bring them in or you can sue them in another court. But to sit back and say that, oh, they owe this, and I'm not going to bring them in, but I have cut all the checks, I've collected all the money, I've made all the arrangements, I am literally a first purchaser under the Natural Resource Code, and say that I'm not liable for all of it, it's not a very tenable situation. The Natural Resource Code provides specifically that the first purchaser is responsible to the payee, and the payee is a royalty owner, or a royalty owner is a payee, and no one else is responsible. That places a burden on the operator to be sure the money is paid correctly. And it should be.
Are you saying that division orders cannot be effective in Texas because of the Texas Natural Resources Code?
No, ma'am. I'm saying that whoever purchases the first purchaser of oil or gas is responsible to paying the royalty owners.
How could you have an effective division order under your construction of the Texas Natural Resources Code?
The Texas Natural Resource Code has a division order form that asks that the operators issue that form. They don't do it. You put the stamp on there. I think what you have in the division order is a very simple thing. You have a decimal inch. And everybody's agreeing that's the decimal inch.
But what if that decimal interest doesn't coincide with the fraction in the lease?
If the decimal interest is in error, they have a dispute, and somebody should catch it and file off to them. But that is mainly all the division order does is set out the decimal interest ownership of each party.
So you're saying there's no protection under a division order for anyone or for the payor?
Yes, ma'am. There is a provision of the Natural Resource Code about title disputes.
I'm talking about if the percentage, the decimal fraction set out in the division orders, doesn't it perfectly coincide with the lease percentages? Are you saying division orders are ineffective to provide
protection to the payor? I'm saying if you sign a division order that has a decimal interest, you're bound to that to use a book. But that's about all you're bound to. Did I answer the question? And if you look at the division order form, it's promulgated in the Natural Resource Code. That's about all it states, except for the fact that the payor may withhold payment if there is a title dispute, which brings to the courthouse. The trial court and the Court of Appeals both, whether they articulated the findings of fact and conclusions of law correctly, or ideally, I'm not sure, both came to the correct conclusion, that you have to have gas produced and sold, and that's where the market is. And that's why in this case it's point B. There could be other cases where it might be point C or a different point. But this case, and under these circumstances, that is the place where it was sold, and that's where the market is. It is no different than buying your Cantaloupe FOB Dallas. Dallas would be where the market is. I will give you back some time. Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Thank you, Council. We do need the time.
Your Honor, I really can't believe I just heard what I heard, where this gentleman is saying that market value at the well does not mean market value at the well. Now, there is a Supreme Court case, Your Honor. I would like to tell you exactly what it is, but I know there's been one in recent years where this very question was brought before the court, which the question was, there was a different measure of royalty if the gas was sold at the well as opposed to if the gas was sold not at the well, and this court held that at the well really meant on the leased premises. I'd like to cite you to the exact case, but I know that there is a Supreme Court case. So, and to even further, Your Honor, after this case happened and we were ruled against at the trial court level and the Court of Appeals level, we actually changed the way we marketed the gas.
Do you agree there's no gas sold at the well here?
Your Honor, that is correct. But that's not the question. The question is, where do you determine the value that you pay? If you sell the gas in New York under this lease, you still have to pay based on the market value at the well. If you sell it off the lease premises and you sell it for $2 more, you still are paying the value, paying the royalty based on the market value at the well. That's what the lease says. You can't ignore that language. Your Honor, getting back to the division order question, one other thing that to me it just flies right in the face of this court's holding in the Govinda case. General rule in Texas is that the division order provides for a payment of royalty less than the lease provides is still binding until it's revoked. In Govinda, this court held that that's true unless the purchaser retains some benefit from that. In that instance, Strata had an incorrect title opinion, and instead of paying one-half royalty, they had paid the royalty owners one-half of the royalty, and Strata had retained that interest, so the court said they had to disgorge that. But what is very important in the court's holding was that they only have to pay to the extent they benefited from that mistake. The Court of Appeals in this Circuit Court of Appeals has said if the lessee benefits at all, receives any kind of benefit, then he has to pay the total amount. That is not what the court held in Govinda. In Govinda, the court said that the lessee or the operator, the purchaser, is only liable to the extent that it retained any of those benefits. In this case, if the operator had agreed with the respondent's contention and said, we can't deduct anything, the people who would have paid that would have been the working interest owners in each particular lease. Because ordinarily, the working interest owners pay pre-production and then it's a sharing of the post-production. But if we had agreed with their interpretation, we had said working interest owners have to pay all the transportation costs. So the people who would have paid that would have been the working interest owners in each particular lease, and they would have paid only to the extent that they owned the working interest. Our Heritage in two of the leases owned no working interest. So they didn't benefit at all from the deduction of the transportation costs. In some of the other leases, they own varying percentages, so they only benefited during that period of time to the extent that they owned a working interest in that lease. And the last thing that's just totally, and one of the other justices pointed this out earlier, it's totally hard to believe that by virtue of the fact that Mr. Weisenbaker owns 100% of Heritage, and he owns 50% of the gathering line, how that benefits Heritage is beyond belief if there are no allegations, no proof of any alter ego, of any anything that would say they're alter ego, or anything that showed that the cost of transporting that was unreasonable. They agreed that the cost was reasonable. So if, what difference does it make whether a company owned 50% by Mr. Weisenbaker transports the gas from point A to point B? The working interest owners are the ones who benefited, if anyone benefited. And they only benefited to the extent that they own a working interest in that particular lease. Now, with respect to bringing in the other parties, and we had the right to bring in the other parties, part of the record that the court will look is we filed a motion to abate after the partial summary judgment was entered, and before the trial was set to go, we filed a motion to abate until such time.
Excuse me, counsel, your time has expired.
Okay.
And are there any questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the second call. The court will now take another brief recess.
Yes.